It's February 1st, 1985, at the annual trade show for the National Association of Music Merchants, or NAMM, in Anaheim, California. Dozens of reporters are waiting for Fender president Bill Schultz. They're expecting a major announcement about his struggling guitar company. In the meantime, they speculate wildly.
I bet some Japanese company bought it. My money's on Yamaha. I hear they couldn't find a buyer. I wouldn't be surprised if this turns into a wake.
In 1985, Fender is still one of the world's most iconic guitar brands. But two decades of mismanagement by its parent company, CBS, have left it in shambles. And for the first time in 30 years, guitars have fallen out of fashion. Fewer teens are commandeering their parents' garages to turn them into practice stages for their bands. No, they're hovering over video games, personal computers, and the decade's trendiest instrument, the synthesizer. Photographers jump in front of Schultz as he walks into the Hilton Hotel ballroom. He's in his late 50s, round-faced and jovial. He was brought in to get Fender back on track, and he's well-liked by employees. He's an amateur musician with an MBA and an engineering degree, ideal for a guitar company president. But not even Schultz could turn Fender around. Now, with guitar sales plummeting industry-wide, CBS is looking to unload Fender to the highest bidder. Schultz steps to the podium. Cameras flash. Reporters flip open their notepads and point their cassette recorders at him.
Thank you all for coming. It gives me great pleasure to announce that a group of Fender employees and private investors, led by myself and other company executives, will purchase the Fender Electric Instrument Division.
The reporters strain to hear the rest of Schultz's statement over the cheers from the audience. For Fender loyalists, this is the best possible outcome. Ownership by Fender's own employees, the people who know and love its guitars better than anyone. Schultz fields a few questions from reporters.
How much did you pay?
Sorry, that's confidential.
Can you say what's included in the sale?
Everything made under the Fender brand. That includes guitars, amplifiers, plus other Fender product lines, including Rhodes pianos, Roger drums, and Polaris synthesizers.
Fender's lost money each of the last 3 years, right? How do you plan to make it profitable again?
Well, we have to downsize, and there will be layoffs. But we're confident that with some improvements in our core products, we can keep this legendary company alive for many years to come.
Schultz wraps up the press conference. He feels both exhilaration and dread. Schultz pulled Fender back from the brink of extinction. CBS was prepared to liquidate the company if it couldn't get a fair price. But it's still hanging by a thread. If they can't find a new factory and get back into production soon, Fender could be toast for good. Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel, you know when it comes to love.
See you soon.
Can't wait.
The sky is no limit. You know with your Delta Amex card, being oceans apart means meeting in Aruba. And booking a war travel with your card means saving 15% on Delta flights. You know kissing under the bridge of sighs guarantees eternal love. Because you're the long-distance lovebirds. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Take off 15 discount not applicable to partner-operated flights or taxes and fees. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars.
Thank you.
On our last episode, just as rock music and 1960s counterculture were gaining steam, large corporations bought Fender and Gibson, planning to boost their size and profitability. They did that by cutting corners, diminishing quality, and their cool factor. Now, in the early 1980s, both Fender and Gibson are struggling financially. It's up to new owners to restore these hallowed brands, but the question is, with guitar sales down, can both companies survive? This is Episode 5, Back from the Brink. August 1985. For months, Bill Schulz and his chief guitar designer, Dan Smith, have been searching for some place to put Fender's new factory. And today, it looks like they might have found it. The building is an empty warehouse in a nondescript industrial park in the city of Corona, about 50 miles east of Los Angeles, not far from Fender's former hometown. The space is only 14,000 square feet, barely one-tenth the size of the old factory. Schulz watches as Smith walks the warehouse's perimeter, studying its dimensions. The two have worked together for nearly 10 years, first at Yamaha's musical instruments division, then at Fender under CBS. Schulz calls out to the guitar designer from across the warehouse.
What do you think, Dan? Think you can make this work?
It'll be a tight squeeze, but yeah, this could work. And it's close enough to the old factory that most of our staff won't mind the commute. I say we take it.
Great. I'll make them an offer. It'll be good to start making guitars again.
By October, the new factory is up and running. Production is extremely limited at first, only about 10 guitars a day. But it's a start. Gibson is retooling too. In 1984, the company closes its factory in Kalamazoo, which had been in continuous operation for 67 years. It moves its guitar production to a newer, cheaper facility in Nashville. But it's not enough. In 1985, Gibson reports losses of $12.6 million, the equivalent of $30 million in today's dollars. Gibson's parent company, Norlin, has had it. They put their storied guitar division up for sale, asking price $5 million. And in January of 1986, they find their buyer. In their New York office, 32-year-old entrepreneur Henry Juskowitz and his business partners pop the cork on a bottle of champagne to celebrate the purchase. The three scruffy Harvard Business School grads now get to add some rock and roll cool factor to their pedigrees. Buying Gibson was too good for them to pass up, no matter how troubled the company may be. Juskowitz takes a swig of champagne and passes the bottle.
It's official, boys. We're now the proud owners of the Gibson Guitar Company. Rock on, Henry.
But another partner looks at Juskowitz like a deer caught in the headlights.
Now what the hell do we do?
Now we go to Nashville and convince them we're not a case of meet the new boss same as the old boss.
Juskowitz can pretty much count on people in Nashville being suspicious of three Harvard interlopers trying to revive a revered guitar like Gibson. They've already had 17 years of mismanagement under Norlin. Folks in Tennessee surely won't be impressed that their only connection to the music business is through one of their other companies, Phi Technologies, and its client, Muzak, whose sappy instrumentals are piped into elevators, grocery stores, and doctors' waiting rooms across America. But Juskowitz has played guitar since he was a teenager, and he brings an enthusiastic rock and roll attitude to the job. During a visit to Gibson's Nashville factory in spring of 1986, he jumps up onto a workbench. Machinists stop work and stand silently as Juskowitz waits for quiet to address the large group of employees.
Look, I know you all probably think I'm just another guy with an MBA who's going to come in here and tell you how to make guitars. I know you all probably call me the Muzak man behind my back. And that's cool. But look, I'm not here to tell you how to do your jobs. I'm here to listen. Okay? What do you think we can do to get this company back on track? We'll do whatever it takes to honor Gibson's legacy and rebuild it for the future. Now, are you with me?
We're with you, Muzak man.
Juskowitz and his partners have no time to waste.
That's because at Fender, Bill Schultz and Dan Smith have a few moves of their own.
In January 1987, in Fender's showroom at the NAMM trade show in Anaheim, designer Smith shows off the new revamped Stratocaster. Curious guitar players hold the cherry red demo in their hands with reverence.
We're calling it the American Standard Stratocaster. Looks just like the original, but with several key improvements.
How do you improve on a Strat? It's a classic.
I couldn't agree more. But check this out. We've added a one-piece maple neck, a reverse polarity middle pickup to reduce hum, a fully redesigned tremolo arm. Here, try it out, see what you think.
He hands the Strat to one of the guitar players, who plugs in and strums a few chords.
Man, this thing is bitchin'. Nice to see Fender's finally making good guitars again.
The American Standard line of Stratocasters proves to be a smart move on Fender's part, even though it flies in the face of what other guitar makers are doing. All around the NAMM trade show, newer companies like Jackson, Kramer, and BC Rich are displaying flashy new guitars with odd shapes and glossy, eye-popping finishes. They want to appeal to a growing genre of music that's making guitars popular again. Heavy metal. It's loud, over the top, and thanks to MTV, bands like Van Halen, Judas Priest, and Def Leppard tend to play showy, over-the-top guitars in their videos. Some of them even use a classic, Gibson's Flying V guitar. It was unpopular when it was first released in 1958, but its dramatic V-shaped body is a perfect look for heavy metal. It's tempting for Fender to try to compete with all that flash, but Smith knows that while metal bands may want wild-looking guitars on MTV, in the studio, many of them still play vintage Stratocasters and Telecasters. Loyalty to Fender's flagship products runs deep. If he can tap into that loyalty with an improved, updated Strat, well, they'll have a hit on their hands. The strategy works. In a matter of months, Fender's little Corona factory is operating in double shifts at full capacity. To meet demand, the company opens a second factory just over the border in Ensenada, Mexico. Guitar magazines and music industry trade papers hail Bill Schultz and Dan Smith for bringing Fender back from the brink. Back in Nashville, Henry Juskowitz is keeping a close eye on Fender's comeback. He's thinking about those baby boomers who grew up idolizing the Les Paul players like Eric Clapton and Jimmy Page, who are now all middle-aged with plenty of disposable income. He figures that's the perfect way for Gibson to tap into that nostalgia market too. But the company has neglected their best nostalgia ambassador, guitarist Les Paul. By the time Juskowitz bought Gibson, no one at the company had spoken to Paul in years. With Gibson still struggling financially, Juskowitz is determined to mend fences with Paul. And fortunately for him, these days the guitarist is not hard to find. New York City, spring 1987. In jeans and a black leather jacket, Juskowitz ducks into Fat Tuesday's, a seedy basement jazz club that reeks of stale beer in Lower Manhattan. He's come to see the Les Paul Trio. Paul played his first show here about 3 years ago, and it was so successful, it evolved into a weekly residency. Now, Paul drives into New York from rural New Jersey every Monday night to play old jazz standards and tell corny jokes for a small but appreciative crowd. Often, famous guitarists drop in to pay their respects. Jimmy Page and Keith Richards are frequent visitors, and recently even the reclusive Bob Dylan showed up. Inside, Juskowitz slides into his reserved seat at a cafe table near the stage and orders a beer. A few minutes later, Paul steps onto the club's cramped stage with a second guitar player and an upright bassist. Paul's in his early 70s now, thin and a little frail-looking under a blue turtleneck. He sits down, grabs a black Gibson Les Paul, and looks out at the audience. A smile spreads across his face that melts away the decades.
Hello, everyone. My name is Les Paul. Thanks so much for coming out tonight.
Paul has arthritis, but you'd never know it from his playing. He's as fleet-fingered as ever. Juskowitz is impressed. Wow, the old guy still got it. After the show, Juskowitz approaches the stage and introduces himself. Paul sizes him up and grins.
You sure you're the new president of Gibson? You don't look old enough to drink.
I swear it's me, sir.
Well, give me a few minutes to pack up and I'll meet you at the bar.
As Fat Tuesday's staff stacks chairs and sweeps the floors, Paul and Juskowitz sit and chat for over an hour. Despite their difference in age, they feel an immediate connection. Both have a fondness for off-color jokes, and Paul is impressed with the Gibson CEO's knowledge of guitars. When it's clear they're finally about to be kicked out, Juskowitz makes his pitch.
Hey, Les, you've got a birthday coming up soon, right?
Don't remind me. I'll be 186 years old.
Well, 72 is what I heard. Anyway, why don't you let Gibson throw you a party to help celebrate? The company hasn't done enough to honor you, and, well, I'd like to fix that.
You'd be honoring me more if you fixed everything that's wrong with the Les Paul. They've changed so much over the years, it's barely the same guitar.
I'm way ahead of you, Les. Our design team is working on a little birthday present for you as we speak. I think you'll be impressed.
Juskowitz leaves Fat Tuesdays that night, determined to give Paul the birthday bash of a lifetime. That's the easy part. Now, he also has to win Paul's trust. If he can do that, then maybe Paul will actively endorse Gibson's latest guitars, and Juskowitz can save Gibson from the scrap heap.
You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One. Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's Zoho.one. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind. Around 10 in the evening on June 9th, 1987, a black limousine pulls up outside the Hard Rock Cafe in Midtown Manhattan. As the limo doors open, bouncers push back on the crush of spectators and paparazzi hoping for a glimpse of whoever's about to step out. The party inside the Hard Rock is a who's who of rock royalty. Already, Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, and Robbie Krieger of the Doors have arrived. Who could be next?
Who the hell is that?
Don't you know? That's the guest of honor, Les Paul.
Paul is fashionably late to his 72nd birthday bash. Wearing a blue turtleneck and a big smile, he waves to the cameras as his oldest son helps him inside the club. The Hard Rock is packed shoulder to shoulder with music industry bigwigs, rock stars, and assorted celebrities. Glancing around, Paul sees Tony Bennett, Dr. John, Bo Diddley. Paul's had famous friends for 40 years, but even for him, well, it's a little overwhelming. With some effort, Paul's son guides him across the room to where Henry Juskowitz is standing next to a cake the size of a coffee table.
Les, about time you got here.
I hope you don't expect me to blow out all those candles, Henry.
No, but I do expect you to play.
He presents Paul with a birthday present he promised. A reissued 59-style Gibson Les Paul guitar. Later that night, Paul leads an all-star jam session backed by Paul Schaefer's band from Late Night with David Letterman. Tony Bennett comes up to sing a few songs. Jimmy Page hops on stage to rip a few solos. Paul is pleased to find that his new guitar feels and sounds remarkably like the original. The jam session continues late into the night. The party doesn't start winding down until 3 a.m. Paul leaves exhausted, but elated. For Juskowitz, the evening couldn't have gone any better. His gambit to win back Gibson's legendary endorser has paid off. For a couple of months, Gibson basks in the glow of the successful event. All of the major news outlets gush over the party's A-list attendees and star-studded jam session. Rolling Stone features a photo of Les with Jeff Beck and Jimmy Page with the caption, "St. Paul and His Disciples." And the positive press has the desired effect. Sales of the Gibson Les Paul surge. Then, in August, just 2 months after the party, Juskowitz walks through the lobby of the Gibson corporate headquarters in Nashville. The latest issue of Guitar Player, one of the industry's most influential magazines, is stacked in the lobby waiting area, and on the cover is a cherry red Stratocaster next to the headline, Stratmania. Juskowitz takes the magazine to his office and angrily flips through the pages. Guitar Player has devoted not just one article, but an entire section to the Stratocaster, which they're naming the Guitar of the Decade. Their argument is based not so much on the Stratocaster's quality, but its ubiquity. By 1987, nearly every company makes their own knockoff version of a Stratocaster. They're called Super Strats if they're higher end, or SLOs, Strat-like objects, if they're cheap. Since 1981, Fender has filed over 30 trademark claims against them, and still the imitators come. Even more amazingly, the knockoffs have done virtually nothing to dampen the original's popularity. Fender's 1987 catalog features more different versions and models of Stratocasters than ever before. While Gibson struggles to jumpstart its comeback, Fender's is already well underway. Juskowitz isn't the only one fuming at Guitar Player magazine's homage to the Strat. At G&L Guitars in Fullerton, Leo Fender sweeps the latest copy of Guitar Player off his drafting table and into the trash. He founded G&L in 1979 to release a new line of guitars that to him are far superior to those made by the company he sold off in 1965. But after a few successful years, G&L's sales have stagnated. And what's worse, many guitar players compare G&L's products unfavorably to Fender's. To Leo Fender's mind, this is absurd. His old company's essentially still making the same guitars he designed over 30 years ago, and his new creations for G&L look and sound superior. But Fender's new owners keep pushing the nostalgia factor, this bizarre idea that older is better. It makes no sense, and Leo Fender is getting sick of, in effect, competing against his younger self. With his jeweler's magnifying glasses still perched on his forehead, he shuffles down the hall to the office of G&L's head of sales, Dale Hyatt. Hyatt wraps up a sales call and greets his boss.
What can I do for you, Leo?
I want you to cancel all our ads in Guitar Player. I've had it with those idiots.
Look, Leo, that Stratmania cover pissed me off too, but do you really think that's wise? Guitar Player's circulation is huge.
We don't need them, Dale. We don't need them. We can sell just as many with word of mouth.
Fine.
I'll make the call.
Leo Fender goes back to his drafting table and resumes work on his latest project. But as he sketches, he feels a sudden spasm in his drawing hand. His pencil twitches. He erases his mistake and tries again, with the same result. Few people know it yet, but Leo Fender has Parkinson's disease. For a man who prides himself on his meticulous handiwork, it's a devastating illness. But he's determined to fight through it. Even now, at age 78, Leo Fender still has something to prove. He wants to prove to the world that he can design a guitar even better than the Stratocaster. On the next episode, Henry Juskowitz's increasingly wild behavior spells trouble for Gibson. Leo Fender and Les Paul take their final bows, and declining sales threaten not just Fender and Gibson, but the entire guitar industry.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. We hope you enjoyed this episode. A quick note about the conversations in this episode. We can't know exactly what was said, but this dialogue is based on our best research. I'm your host, David Brown. Andy Herman wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Emily Frost and Donna Hyams edited this story. Our editor and producer is Jenny Lauer Beckman. Sound designed by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producer is Marshall Louie. Created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.